Ladies and gentlemen, after that surprising, perhaps unnecessary build-up, I'm sorry you're going to have such a flop. But I believe you have had a galaxy of talented speakers this year, so you won't mind finishing perhaps with a bad one. However, our moon of my delight, who knows no wane, the moon of heaven is rising once again. How oft hereafter rising shall she look through this same garden after me in vain? So sang the Persian astronomer poet Omar Khayyam in an old world Persian garden nearly 800 years ago. In the Middle Ages, the moon and the stars in the heavens aroused a sense of beauty in mankind. Just imagine a magic Italian night in the Middle Ages. The lovelorn Romeo gazes at the star-clad sky and sighs, "Lady, by yonder blessed moon I swear, the tips with silver all these fruit tree tops." But Juliet answers, "Swear not by the moon, the inconstant moon, that monthly changes in her circled orb, lest that thy love prove likewise variable." And Marlowe, as well as Shakespeare, was thrilled by the stars and the heavens. You all remember how Mephistopheles conjured up for the enamored Faust the vision of Helen. Was this the face that launched a thousand ships and burned the topless towers of Ilium? "Thou art fairer than the evening air, clad in the beauty of a thousand stars." When we gaze at the sky, do we not subconsciously feel the magic that thrilled the ancients? Don't we gaze up at the sky and see these myriads of glowing stars, and don't we feel perhaps that on one of those distant stars some fellow soul too is looking up into his sky, perhaps to a very faint star, our own sun, and don't we feel some communion of soul with all the living beings and entities throughout this wonderful universe? The early Greeks were really thrilled at the magic of the heavens. They gazed at the star-clad skies and thought they saw a wondrous ornament. The Greek ornament is cosmos, and it is certainly very felicitous of you, Mr. Chairman, and Norman Oliver, to christen your society Cosmos, the love of beauty. And I must say, when I gaze around this audience, I feel like a Faust thrilled by 100 Helens. I'm afraid I feel really as if I'm here under false pretenses. I cannot claim to be an historian, nor a scientist. I happen, in fact, to be head of the customs and excise in Sunderland, a seeker after truth in perhaps a more practical fashion. However, though, perhaps I have... Well, I'm not without qualifications entirely, really. One of my colleagues some time since wrote a very well-known book on UFOs, describing perhaps the most famous UFO in all history. And Jesus, passing thence, saw Matthew sitting at the seat of custom, and he said unto him, "Follow me." And he followed him. So I, perhaps, in my own we, in a wonderful way, are trying to follow in the footsteps of no less a person than St. Matthew. Actually, I rather envy you people living in the south of England, near London. In Sunderland, I really feel isolated completely from the world. And it may surprise you to learn that I never, at any time in Sunderland, discuss space with anybody, although I do, as it happens, give quite a lot of talks on the subject. Another, perhaps, qualification to which the linguists among you may construe. My name, Drake, comes from the Latin draco, meaning dragon, and I have proved, to my own satisfaction, but I regret to say to nobody else's, Marco, that the dragons of antiquity were spacemen. Re, as you know, was the Egyptian sun god, and Mond is a German word for moon. So I suppose, really, I could... it would be rather difficult for me to claim to be a spaceman from the sun or moon. But, however, for tonight, just regard me as a spaceman from Sunderland, which, to most of you, would probably be more remote than Mars. 400 years ago, the discoveries of Copernicus and Kepler ushered in a new age. Their teachings, reviving some of the ancient Greek teachings, of course, that the Earth went round the sun, flouted all that was taught in the Bible. And in 1600, that really marvellous man, Giordano Bruno, who not only taught that the Earth went round the sun, but taught of countless planets in infinite space, with inhabitants, inhabited life all over the universe. He was imprisoned for 8 years and burnt at the stake by the Inquisition. Galileo, as you know, got off somewhat lighter. He did recant, but he was allowed to some extent to expound his teachings. As a matter of interest, although the Inquisition suppressed him to some extent, Cardinal Bellarmine did say that if Galileo's teachings were proved to be correct, then the scriptures would have to be altered. Contrast those attitudes with the attitude today. Despite all the publicity given to spacemen in UFOs, has our own church changed its attitude? Has our church decided that the scripture and the church's teachings will have to be amended? Galileo, as we know, discovered the moons of Jupiter through the newly invented telescope. He asked professors at Pisa University to look through the telescope at these satellites. None of them would, in case they saw them. Now, isn't that exactly the attitude of science today, particularly of the Condon Committee? Will the scientists, in the church for that matter, really take cognizance of this wonderful event of our century? The discovery, really, that people from other planets are not only visiting Earth now, but have visited Earth in the past. We have an awful lot to say about the Inquisition and the intolerance of the early church, for which there appears to be very little excuse. But as we well know, the church and the scientists are not much different today. It seems to me, ladies and gentlemen, that we actually are the Galileos of the 20th century. However, I often wonder, really, whether students of UFOs are approaching the subjects from the right point of view. Those of you who are interested in astrology and the occult know that our world is passing into the age of Aquarius, which means really that all our thinking should be reorientated. I myself, I'm not sorry to say, perhaps I'm glad to say, I'm one of the most ignorant have met. I mean that, and I hope the time will come when I will be really ignorant, because, ladies and gentlemen, I feel that ignorance is the beginning of wisdom. What I have tried to do, admittedly not with very much success, is to try to think cosmically, to try to view Earth from a different viewpoint. All of you will remember those marvellous photographs taken by the cosmonauts, which shows our Earth is a tiny ball. Seems rather odd when you look at those photographs of the Earth, probably about as big as a tennis ball, and realise that our Earth is infested by 3,000 million people. As a matter of fact, in ancient times, and I think to some extent some people today, thought that our Earth was actually alive, that our Earth, oddly enough, was a living being, and that we infest the Earth just like microbes, and that the character of the Earth, and to some extent, oddly enough, the weather, is affected by the thought patterns of the people on it. However, I think really we should try to unlearn, try to forget our conditioned mode of thought and thought pattern, and try to look at our Earth and look at its evolution and its history from a detached point of view, just as if we were a Martian or a being from Sirius or beyond, looking at our Earth in perspective. Well, our universe, as far as we know, appears to be about 5,000 million years old. The yogis believe, and yoga is a subject I hesitate to discuss, it's perhaps more dear to my heart than flying saucers. We think that God, or the deity, or the absolute, is imagining our universe into existence. And that our universe and we ourselves are creations, mental creations, of God. The ancient Hindus actually worked out that our universe lasts for 154 billion years. It expands to 77 million from a primeval, really, thought pattern, supporting the Big Bang theory, and then expands for 77 million years, then contracts. Then the absolute, or God, goes to sleep. Nothing happens. And for a similar period, there is nothing. And then the universe starts up all over again. A succession of cyclic universes, which was taught by the ancient Hindus and also by the Greeks. And that we ourselves, just as the universe lives life after life, so we live life after life too. Our Earth is believed to be about 4,500 million years old. These figures are rather important, as I shall explain in a moment. Actually, a Russian, Paul Gerling, claims that our Earth is not 4,500 million years old, but actually is 12,000 million years old. Now, in this tremendous time, obviously wonderful things have happened. Civilizations have risen and fallen. And our Earth at times has been struck, so we believe, by huge comets. Herbiger, the Austrian cosmologist, taught that four previous suns crashed into our Earth, destroying civilizations. And peoples all over the world generally believe that before our present civilization, there have been at least four previous civilizations. You see, we know very, very little about ancient times. One of the most desolating things to a student of ancient history is the fact that, odd as it might seem to you, there seem to be very, very few records. Most of the records, of course, were destroyed by fire and flood. Many were destroyed by emperors. Nabonassar, the emperor of Babylon, in the year 723, destroyed all written records. He wanted history the start from that particular date. In the year 213, the Chinese Emperor Huang Pi destroyed all the records in China. As you probably know, the Spaniards, notably Bishop Landa, in the 17th century, destroyed all the records in Mexico. And every time you try to delve back to history, you find that there are very, very few records left. But I think, you know, that our archaeologists are wrong in many respects. Because surely it seems to be quite wrong to try to write history just based on archaeological finds. For example, anybody excavating the hut of Homer, who lived about, as far as we know, about 800 BC, would obviously find practically nothing. And yet, the writings of Homer and Hesiod, about the same date, have not been surpassed. The oldest literature, for example, appears to be probably Akhenaten's really marvellous Hymn to the Sun, written about 1370, the Gilgamesh epic, which probably goes back to about 2500 BC, and the Ramayana, which is dated about 1800, and the Mahabharata in India about 1400 BC. But, ladies and gentlemen, these marvellous writings show such wonderful language and such exquisite thought that surely men must have evolved for thousands, tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of years to produce such wonderful modes of thought and such marvellous language. Also, in chemistry, the ancient Chinese had absolutely marvellous pharmaceutical preparations. The Chinese, the Aztecs, the Babylonians and the Egyptians, as far as we know, for over 3,000 or 4,000 BC, did the most wonderful gold work and had the most wonderful metallurgy, which surely they must have inherited from civilizations many generations ago. I think one useful byproduct of the interest in UFOs and spacemen in antiquity is that it is resurrecting the lost continents of the past with perhaps more enthusiasm and more proof than before. Some years ago, I wrote a series of articles for the Flying Saucer Review, which, on the advice of Brinsley Laporte Trench, were published in Gods or Spacemen, published by Ray Palmer in 1964. And I tried to give a picture of what I thought was gods or spacemen in the past. Unfortunately, Palmer published only 1,000 copies, and they were restricted to private sale. And actually, believe it or not, I myself advertised 2 or 3 times in Flying Saucer Reviews for copies, and could not get any. Palmer reprinted 1,000 copies last year. In Gods or Spacemen, I do try to give some idea from the ancient records of these lost, not only of the lost continents, but of lost civilizations. I shall deal with most of the countries of the world shortly, but just to give you an idea of the principal dates, I shall just mention a few to you. It is my belief that for about 2,000 years, that spacemen were active on our own Earth. For example, in an ancient Chinese record, the Xu Qing, in the year 2400 BC, they say, the Lord on high was very displeased with the Chinese and the wickedness in China. There was a tribe with the perhaps rather singly name Mao, the Mao Tse, whether they were distant ancestors of Mao Zedong, we don't know. The God took away from them the power to fly, and that China at that time was troubled by stupendous wars. The Japanese records state that in the 2346 BC, 10 suns appeared in the sky all at once, and 9 of them were shot down by a character called Su Yu, the divine archer. We perhaps might look upon the 10 suns in the sky, still at all, or suns seen in the sky in Roman times, perhaps as UFOs. A very little known Japanese work called the Seiki To mentions that in the year 2300 BC, a man descended in Korea from the sky under a sandal tree, actually, and that he lived in Korea for 1,000 years, recalling that marvellous character of about whom I also write in God's Spaceman, Count Saint-Germain. In the year 2000 BC, according to Dionysius of Halicarnassus in his writings, and mark you, we are a bit uncertain about the date, Minos of Crete was presented with the laws by Zeus, evoking, of course, Moses receiving the Ten Commandments from God. Also, about 2000 BC, a Chipsan tomb in Japan depicts 7 suns over Kyoto, and it shows a drawing of the Emperor of Japan making an praying or kneeling to these 7. Of course, we would call them UFOs in the sky. About the year 1800 BC, there was the famous Indian Ramayana. This is a really marvellous story about Rama's quest for his wife Sita, who had been abducted to Ceylon by the evil genius Ravan. And the writer Valmiki described battles in the air between Rama and Ravan. He described marvellous celestial spaceships, and if one read it with modern eyes, one would be absolutely certain, I think, that you were reading about celestials from the skies in wonderful UFOs. In 1785, the Babylonians, King Hammurabi, also received laws from the Babylonian sun god Shamash, evoking again Moses and Minos. In 1500 BC, of course, you have those circles of fire alleged to have been seen over the court of Thutmose III. I know in most UFO books you will have read about that and the translation of the papyrus by Count Rakovils. Actually, I wrote to the British Museum about that, trying to verify it, and the Department of Egyptology wrote back the rather vague, I think it's the Tullio papyrus, but they're rather vague about it, so I don't think that Egyptologists themselves believe it. Now, in 1400 BC, Knossos, the capital of Crete, was destroyed. Now, I know perfectly well that almost all historians and geologists attribute the destruction of Knossos to earthquakes. I think the latest theory is that Knossos was destroyed by the explosion of Santorin Island in the Mediterranean not far away. In fact, it probably, if the truth were known, it probably was destroyed by earthquakes. But then, on the other hand, as I shall mention later, cities do appear to have been destroyed by extraterrestrial action. And although it seems a bit improbable, it isn't beyond the bounds of possibility that Knossos itself might have been destroyed by spacemen, especially as one or two geologists, or somebody who disagrees with the experts, say that from the evidence at Knossos itself, the fires and whatnot that were started don't appear to have been started by earthquakes. And in the year, about the year 1400, in India, we get now to the Mahabharata. This is a 9 days war in northern India, a war waged by Prince Arjuna, aided by the god Krishna, who were fighting another claimant to the kingdom, actually, in northern India. Now, this war, it is described in the Mahabharata in absolutely fantastic detail, not only with flying ships, but also these, what we would call, hydrogen bombs, or nuclear bombs, stupendous bombs that wipe out whole armies, destroy herds of elephants, and actually not only shatter cities, but make the very universe quake. If you read these accounts of the Mahabharata written, as far as we know, about 1400 years ago, you would swear, ladies and gentlemen, that you were reading an account similar to the destruction of Hiroshima. And following the year 1400, you notice I'm switching from country to country because I want to get this particular data in chronological order. These are the few records we have from that time. In 1375, in Egypt, ruled this marvellous, really marvellous king, Akhenaten. I know some people think he was not a great king, that he was a pacifist, and while he reigned, he tried to usher in a kingdom of peace and enlightenment, and finally he was overthrown and the rule of Amun restored. But when he became king, he was only about 14 or 15, and he showed such immense wisdom that, frankly, I, at least, would not be surprised if he were inspired by the spacemen who I believed were visiting Earth around about that time. And then, as I may discuss later, if I have time, about the year 1200 BC, there was the Trojan War. I'm sure you will have read at least some of the marvellous accounts either in the Iliad or later on in the Odyssey, that the gods took sides in the siege of Troy. Well, the gods and goddesses are described with such vivid detail that I prefer to think that they were spacemen. For example, suppose the Russians and the Americans, suppose they are visiting Mars or one of the planets, and just suppose there is a local war on Mars or on one of the planets that they visit. Well, it's quite possible that the Americans and the Russians may give advice to different sides, even if they don't actually interfere in the fighting. Well, I prefer to believe that the gods were, or the spacemen were, actually present during the siege of Troy. Now, the Bible says that in about the year 915, Solomon's temple was built. Well, Solomon's temple, so it says in Kings, was built by angels and by cherubim, which who are now, I said which, there's some confusion really, is when the word cherubim refers to a fiery wheel, that is to, perhaps to a spaceship itself, or actually to the people manning it. I think Solomon's temple in 950 was probably constructed with the help of an extraterrestrial. Now, Babylonian and Assyrian reliefs and statues show for the year 880 BC the king Shalmaneser II accompanied by winged beings. I think that they were spacemen who were advising him, and that they were given wings just to denote that they came from space. Similarly, about 20 years later, in about the year 860, the Babylonian king Assurbanipal III, he was depicted accompanied by beings with wings. I know this probably sounds a bit fatuous, but just suppose for the sake of argument, that beings did land from one of the planets on our Earth, you see, and after we had sort of got used to them, and they appeared with our own royalty. Well, I dare say, really, that perhaps they might be drawn, perhaps with wings, just to denote that they were not Earthlings like ourselves, but had come from other planets. And in the year 850, according to most chronology, lived Elijah. Well, we know, but according to the Bible, that Elijah used to pray to this heaven and call down fire on his enemies, and that Elijah was translated, or alleged to have been translated to the skies, about the year 850. In the year 800, lived an absolutely marvellous queen of Babylon, Queen Semiramis. You may remember some reference to her by Shakespeare in Midsummer Night's Dream, where Pyramus and Tisbe go and make love by old Ninny's tomb. Ninny, or Ninus, was her husband to Semiramis, and she raised a tomb, so the Babylonians reckon, about a mile long and about a mile high. And a mile wide, it seems a rather impossible thing, but she was an absolutely fabulous queen, and she led the Babylonian and Assyrian armies to Egypt and right to India. Her father was deemed to be Oannes, the Babylonian god, and her mother was Atriates, who was a fish goddess. And then, in the year 716, Romulus, I'll have more to say about this later on if I have time, Romulus was whisked to heaven in a cloud. He was giving judgment on the Palatine Hill, when a cloud came down from the sky, so he told us anyway, and Romulus was whisked off to heaven. In the year 660 BC, the Japanese Emperor Jimmu was helped, according to the Kojiki in the Nihongi, Japanese ancient record. He was aided by celestials in his war against the Ainu of northern Japan. Excuse me. In the year 640, one of the early Roman emperors, Tullus Hostilius, he and all his family were destroyed by fire from heaven. In the year 630, as far as we know it anyway, Zoroaster received the laws of Persia from Ahura Mazda, the great Persian god, sky god, whom many of us think was the Persian name for denoting a spaceman. And in 593, we had Ezekiel by the river Chebar in Babylon saw his famous wheel. In 536, according to the Bible, Daniel met an angel or a being who is described very much and almost the same words practically as Adamski's description of Orton from Venus. That is, if you care to believe Adamski. In 508 BC, the city of Bolzano in Italy, so we are told by Pliny, was destroyed by fire from heaven. Lars Porsena was besieging Rome. The Romans were fighting the, I think it's Samnites, or the Etruscans. And Lars Porsena, we believe, enlisted the help of the space people, and according to Pliny, at any rate, Bolzano was practically annihilated by a blast from heaven. In 498 BC, the Romans say that wondrous beings came to the aid of the Romans who were hard-pressed at the Battle of Lake Regulus. In 490 BC, the Greeks allege that wonderful beings aided Leonidas at Marathon. And in 480 BC, a wonderful light, approximation of what we would call a UFO, was seen at the Battle of Salamis. These are a few. I think that have most of the dates between 2400 and about 400, which I, at any rate, prefer to believe were at least some evidence of extraterrestrial visitations. In my book, Ancient East, I, at fairly great length, deal with the spacemen in ancient India, Tibet, China, Japan, Egypt, and Babylon. I very much doubt, seeing as I want to discuss the ancient West with you, I very much doubt really whether I have a great deal of time to mention those. But I shall be glad, I think, to answer any questions about those countries later on. Now, ancient West. Well, after writing Ancient East, I decided to write about the rest of the world. Incidentally, I finished Ancient East in 1966, and the book was not published until 1968. As soon as I had finished Ancient East, I started Ancient West. That took about 3 years, and in January of last year, I deposited with the publisher a 465-page volume, Spacemen in the Ancient West. Perhaps, well, I'm not quite sure really whether it's bad taste by mentioning this, yes, but the bibliography to Ancient West lists 510 items in 9 languages. So you will see that whatever its shortcomings may be, I have at least tried to resurrect as much data as possible for far better brains than my own to interpret. Unfortunately for me, the publisher kept the manuscript 12 months, and although at the beginning I think he was keen on publishing it, unfortunately it was supplanted by Chariot of the Gods. Now, don't think for one moment that I'm criticising Erich von Däniken at all. Good luck to him. The more publicity we can get, and the more books which are published on spacemen both today and yesterday, the more good for the cause. But I personally found it somewhat embarrassing because his articles publicising the book appeared in the Sunday Mirror, and many people in Sandsland came up to me in June of last year thinking that I myself was writing them, because I had given many talks in the Northeast and mentioned almost everything that had appeared in Chariots, my own book, Gods or Spacemen, in 1964, written 5 years before Chariots of the Gods. Has anticipated Däniken to a considerable extent. Well, unfortunately, from my point of view, at any rate, although my publisher had the manuscript January of last year, he did not really, whether he considered it or not, is really not for me to say, but the point is, the Chariots came out in English translation in October, so the publisher returned the manuscript to me after having it 12 months, and I honestly thought he had accepted it. Of course, now I'm looking for another publisher. Well, Spacemen in the Ancient West is a fairly lengthy analysis of spacemen in Lemuria, Atlantis, Ancient Greece, the Etruscans, Rome, Scandinavia, North and South America, Mexico, and Peru, and also Ancient Africa. I shall try to give you a brief resume, but I shall be very glad to try to answer any questions later on. The first three chapters deal with the antiquity of our Earth. I explain very briefly how originally, perhaps about 2,000 million years ago, all the land on our Earth was grouped into one continent called Pangaea, surrounded by a sea called Panthalassia. And then after millions of years, the continent split into two, into Lower Asia and Gondwanaland. Gondwanaland later split up into Lemuria. And I describe, as far as I can from various records and so forth, the Lemurians, who we think lived, of course it's very difficult to get an exact chronology, I know, probably 10 or even 20 million years ago. And many of us believe that there was a very great civilization in the Pacific known as Lemuria, and that the Lemurians were inspired by beings from the planet, notably Venus, although admittedly our astronomers are very doubtful whether life can exist on Venus. Lemuria was finally destroyed by earthquakes, which students of the occult allege, of course, believe this as you may, was really promoted by the black magicians who were using the Lemurian occult forces for evil purposes. Those of you who are familiar with Churchwood's works may recall that I think it's the Children of Mu describes the spaceship used by the Lemurians. The Lemurians, before their continent disappeared, migrated to India and began the earliest Indian civilizations, and also to South America and over to the new continent of Atlantis. In those days, according to the Austrian Herbiger, there was no moon in the sky, and the Atlantis existed as far as we know, I should think, for about a quarter million years. I have three fairly long chapters dealing with Atlantis. There are two schools of thought regarding the credibility of the information for Atlantis. We have a lot of information by psychics such as Rudolf Steiner and Edgar Cayce, and you may have read the book Phylus the Tibetan. Information from discarnate entities and from people who, under hypnosis, have regressed to previous lives. They've regressed to previous lives and they return back to present life or under hypnosis, give us wonderful details alleging that Atlantis had a really brilliant civilization, a civilization probably a couple of hundred years in advance of ours. And then you have perhaps the semi or the quasi-historical side of ancient histories such as Dionysius of Halicarnassus, Plutarch to some extent, and Dio Cassius, who gave veiled hints of this marvellous continent in the West. It's generally believed now, I think, that probably about 12,000 years ago, that the Atlanteans invaded the West, just as the Americans invaded the West on D-Day. In fact, Greek legend states that the Atlantean forces were led by Hercules, and after whom the Pillars of Hercules were named, and that the Atlanteans conquered all Libya, Spain, southern France, and were finally smashed by a coalition of the Athenians and the Egyptians. Many of us think, at least we perhaps would prefer to think, that before Atlantis was finally destroyed, that initiates from Atlantis were rescued by spaceships from Venus. Many of us think that, well, before very long, that our own civilization would probably be destroyed and its spacemen will land and rescue it, the initiates among us. And there are garbled references in the Bible more or less supporting that. What I think is interesting is that about 10,000 BC, Athens seems to have had quite a brilliant civilization. This does conflict with the archaeologists. I think at the present time, the archaeologists say that probably before about 2500 BC, Greece was not even inhabited. Although discoveries at Karol Chutuk in Turkey seems to suggest civilizations not far away, about as far back as 9,000. According to Plato, you know, this is very strange, for almost 2,000 years, Western civilization is hung on to practically every word that Plato wrote. As a matter of fact, Plato and Aristotle between them really hypnotized men for about at least 1,500 years. There was really no progress at all because the church and scholars did and thought as Aristotle and Plato said they should. But Plato's really marvelous account of Atlantis is generally dismissed as science fiction. But actually, I really don't think it can be, because Plato says that he was relating the words of Solon, his great ancestor, who lived about 550 BC, and he had this story from the Egyptian priests. And it's noteworthy that Socrates, Critias, Hermocrates and Socrates present at these discussions, and Socrates, who would argue about anything, never disputed the Atlantis story at all. However, I should be very glad to answer questions later on about ancient Athens. Now, a study of the Greek legends is very revealing. Hesiod, principally, although his tales were garbled to some extent by Ovid about 800 years later, Hesiod writes of the golden age of the gods, the silver age, the bronze age, and the iron age. The golden age was under Cronus. Now, Cronus, actually, he supplanted Uranus. Very little is known about Uranus, but a lot of us are tempted to believe that the Uranids were a most ancient stellar civilization who perhaps landed on our Earth very, very long ago. Our Earth might have been used as a transit base, and really for expeditions from other solar systems through our solar system onto further systems. The Uranids were a very ancient civilization. They were supplanted by Cronus, or Saturn, who was emperor of a marvellous golden age. Actually, the odd thing about these golden ages, in the Greek golden age, and also in the golden age, the Popol Vuh, which you mentioned, the Popol Vuh in Guatemala, mentioned that there were no women. Well, it was a golden age because there were no women. It's a matter of speculation. But I think, really, that during the golden age, Earth was ruled by Saturn, possibly by space beings from the planet Saturn, or the Saturn, or perhaps Saturn's moon. And they were followed by Jupiter, who is identified with the planet Jupiter. And that age was a silver age. Earth was not quite as pleasant as it was under the previous age. The giants rebelled. There was war between heaven and earth, evidence from what we can see all over the world of space wars. There were cataclysms. Berikovsky mentions that comets struck our Earth. In fact, apart from possible interplanetary war, the civilizations on our Earth were disrupted, if not destroyed, by cataclysms. which are mentioned in a garble form, not only in the Greek legends, but in other legends too. Now, Greek literature is very fascinating. We have really some marvellous characters. Crete, for example. We have the marvellous tales about the Minotaur in Daedalus, who appeared to have been Leonardo da Vinci. Daedalus, to escape from the famous labyrinth on Crete, invented, so we're told, invented wings. And he escaped with his son Icarus. Unfortunately, he hadn't invented the law of gravity. Unfortunately for Icarus, they went too high in the sky and his wings fell off and poor Icarus was killed. In a lot of the Greek heroes seem to me to bear a marked resemblance to the prophets of the Old Testament. You have one of the Greek poets, Epalides. He claimed to have gone on a trip to the planets. You have Epimenides, who was out looking for sheep and entered a cave, and when he came out, about 45 years had elapsed. In our present UFO context, we would probably might construe that as being whisked away to another planet. He returned and was noted as a wonderful teacher. Aristaeus, in the 3rd century, was famed for astral travelling and wrote accounts, or somewhat garbled accounts, of astral journeys. Pythagoras was taught, as far as we know, by the druid Abaris, and he is credited with journeying to various countries too. The Greek playwrights also wrote about the gods as if the gods actually existed. The Greek playwrights introduced into Greek tragedy the deus ex machina, which is Latin really for God, from the machine. We think that they refer to the machine as the universe, but it could possibly have been a being from a spaceship. Actually, it's rather an unfortunate business, being a Greek playwright. Aeschylus, for example, he was killed by a falcon dropped a tortoise on Aeschylus's bald head, mistaking it for a rock. Sophocles was choked to death by a grape. Poor Euripides, who was taking shelter with the king of Thrace, was actually torn to pieces by wild dogs. And the Greeks too have one or two rather scanty references to spaceships. For example, in 392 BC, during the fall of Sparta, a spaceship was alleged to have been seen overhead. In 327 BC, Alexander the Great was besieging Tyre, and it is alleged that a fleet of fiery shields descended from the sky and aided Alexander by destroying the walls of Tyre. But I'd be glad to answer any questions on Greece, but I would really like to turn to ancient Rome. The Romans, perhaps more than, and Etruscans, more than any other people of antiquity, worshipped sky gods, and their priests devoted most of their time to studying the sky. The Romans, and the Etruscans before them, ruled their very lives by prodigies seen in the sky. In the about 950 BC, one of the Etruscan kings, Tiberinus fell into the river Albula and was drowned. And the name of the Albula was changed to the river Tiber. Well, Dio Cassius tells us that his grandson, Amulius, who lived about age 50, had inherited a wonderful, apparently inherited, this wonderful electrical science, and he mastered absolutely marvellous powers and could create stupendous damage. Unfortunately, according to Dio Cassius, he raised an earthquake and destroyed his palace and himself when his lake overflowed. Now, Romulus, I think, is an absolutely marvellous character. You may recall that the mother of Romulus, Rhea Silvia, was a Vestal Virgin who was not supposed to marry. Well, she had twins, Romulus and Remus, and she said that her father was the god Mars. Now, Romulus founded Rome, actually on the 21st of April, 753 BC, although he didn't know that it was 753 BC, and he didn't know that he was founding it, I believe, on Shakespeare's birthday. However, be that as it may, Romulus was a very good king indeed. And as I mentioned to you earlier, in the year 716, he was whisked to heaven on a cloud. Classical histories say the same thing happened to Hercules and to Asclepius and to a few other heroes too. Now, this seemed a very tall tale for us, of course, to accept. Although I believe in the Humanoid states that, what are the 21st of November 1952 in Diamantina in Brazil, a Brazilian peasant was actually disappeared in a cloud which was emanated from two balls that were left nearby him by two humanoids about 18 inches high. Now, although it seems a bit difficult for us to believe that people actually disappear in a cloud, both this case in Brazil and I think one or two others that have happened in the last few years seem to support that. There was no evidence that Romulus was murdered. Now, a couple of days afterwards, Julius Proculus, a well-known Roman senator, swore on the most holy of oaths that he had seen Romulus on the road to Rome. And then Romulus said that Rome would develop into a great city. And it seemed, I must say, it seemed very trite, and perhaps you disbelieve it. Friends of mine say, fancy you, Raymond, believing, what a tale to believe that this, what do you say, that this man ascended to heaven, and then his mother was a virgin, his father was a god, he went to heaven, and then he came back from the dead. But fancy a man of your alleged, alleged intelligence believing a tale like that, you say. And I say, yes, but 700 years later, didn't the same thing supposed to have happened to a man called Jesus? Oh, that was different. No, that's the Romans were just plagiarizing the Christians. Well, and then you say, well, how was it that Livy and other historians wrote about this before the birth of Jesus? So this, to me, I've written rather a tendentious chapter on Jesus. I'd be glad to answer questions later on. But you see, we ascribe to Jesus almost the very things that we ridicule about Romulus. Now, the successor of Romulus, Numa Pompilius, was a remarkable fellow. He was probably about the best emperor that Rome ever had. He was a philosopher king. But just one thing I'd like to mention to you before we break for coffee, that he was an absolute marvellous man. He is said to have married a nymph called Egeria. And he tried to pass a law which would have changed human history. If only he could have passed this law, all our lives would have been different. This wonderful man was a philosopher, and he brought before the Roman Senate a law against women who gossip and who meddle in other people's business. And Newman, believe it or not, according to Living, did his very best to get this law passed, which would have changed human history. But unfortunately, he couldn't. So after that, he concentrated on the comparatively simple jobs of controlling lightning. And he used to had a very high reputation in Roman times as a practitioner of this marvellous electrical science that somehow we seem to have lost. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I was hoping to also to cover Scandinavia and the ancient dimensions, and also Rome, to deal with Hannibal and events of the first century and Julius Caesar. But however, I can see that there's hardly time for that. But I should be glad to answer any questions any of you may care to ask, not only on what I have mentioned tonight, but as I say, my studies have covered the whole world, so I should be glad to try, perhaps with scant success, to answer any questions about any country. Thank you.